Israel, especially those who had come from other countries?
Yeah, actually now we send the doctors from outside Gaza through Karm Abu Salem. But, you know, they prevent the Palestinian people, even they are American, to enter Gaza. So they, all the people we send from outside Gaza go through Karm Abu Salem because of Rafah border now is completely closed.
And finally, Dr. Feroz Sidwa, as we hear this devastating description from Raja Musleh, who worked at Al-Shifa and is a Palestinian-American nurse, comes from Gaza City. As you talk about the spaces being closed in this country, I mean, the lack of follow-up on your piece, when you try to speak at, for example, Columbia, it's shut down. You have to go to a local independent bookstore. And yet the Times did publish this column and what it's meant, the kind of response that you've gotten. You haven't stopped since you've come back, as you organize with doctors and nurses and medical personnel to describe what's happening there. I also wanted to ask your response to the latest letter of the Biden administration saying if they don't stop, improve the situation in Gaza, if Israel doesn't, the U.S. will cut off weapons, not this week or next week or the next week, but in a month.
Yeah. So I think the Times piece is significant in that it might represent a shift in elite opinion about just, like Raja said, enough is enough. I mean, how much more destroyed do they want Gaza to be? And that opens up some possibilities for us to be able to do things that can actually help the people of Gaza, and not just Gaza, but elsewhere as well. The like you mentioned, the Times of Israel, there was a letter leaked apparently to the Times of Israel that the Biden administration sent on Sunday, to Ron Dermer and Yoav Gallant, the strategic affairs and defense ministers in Israel, saying that Israel needs to start immediately but has up to 30 days to improve the humanitarian situation. And they pointed out some interesting things in that letter. They said that in September, the lowest amount of aid that has ever that's gone into Gaza in the past year went in September, which means the least amount that has ever gone into Gaza. Of course, the Israelis will deny that, but it's nevertheless quite obviously true. And they raised the possibility of what they called consequences under NSM 20 and other American laws, meaning the laws that prevent the provision of arms to human rights abusers. Well, I think you played a Reuters journalist pointing out earlier, there's no reason to wait 30 days. It's not like Israel hasn't been attacking Gaza for a year. This has been going on for, like Raja said, long enough. We can stop sending them arms tomorrow, and the U.S. can lead an arms blockade against not just Israel, but Israel and all Palestinian and Lebanese armed groups, and that can stop or at least dramatically decrease the fighting, the death, and the misery immediately.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Feroz Sidwa, a surgeon in California, the San Joaquin General Hospital. His New York Times op-ed, 65 doctors, nurses, and paramedics, what we saw in Gaza. And Raja Musleh, country representative in Gaza of Med Global Medical Humanitarian Aid Group, previously worked as a nurse at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. She is a Palestinian from Gaza. Next up, less than 3 weeks from the election, Kamala Harris is campaigning in Michigan. Will she lose votes over the Biden administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza and Israel's expanding war on Lebanon? We'll speak with Abbas Alawiya. He's co-founder of Uncommitted Movement, a Lebanese American. Stay with us. Danger by Stereolab. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Less than 3 weeks from the election, Kamala Harris is campaigning in Michigan. Will she lose votes over the Biden administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza and expanding war in Lebanon? A Republican candidate, Donald Trump, has opened a new campaign office in the swing state. For more, we're joined by Abbas Alawiya. He is co-founder of the Uncommitted Movement, which grew out of concerns by Democrats over President Joe Biden's policy toward Israel and Gaza. Abbas Alawiya is a former Capitol Hill chief of staff for Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush of Missouri. Before that, former longtime congressional staffer. In recent weeks, his relatives in Lebanon have had to flee their homes over Israeli airstrikes. Abbas, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. We also saw you at the Democratic Convention leading the sit-in overnight, or sleep-in, if you will, outside the DNC, demanding a Palestinian-American voice be heard on the stage, which the DNC did not agree to. But first, tell us about your family. Tell us what's happening in Lebanon to your grandmother and everyone else there.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's great to be on with you and Juan. On my way in, I was on the phone with my family. These days, when it's as hard as it is for Dr. Sidwa and others to have the kernels of truth that we can get from Gaza exposed, I'm finding myself relying more and more on the firsthand accounts of my family members on the ground to really understand what's happening. Because I think what gets lost in the thousands and thousands and thousands, the numbers of humans, of people, of universes, of people we know and love that are being harmed and killed, they're not numbers. They're real people. I'll tell you about my grandmother. My grandmother is an elderly person. She's in her 80s. She has numerous health conditions. Her mobility is severely impaired. She's been forced to flee four different times now since the increased aggression by the Israeli military against Lebanese civilians. She loves being in her home. She loves going out to the stoop, the few steps that she's still able to take so that she can enjoy the breeze. Right now, she's in a foreign place. She's someone who feels like she's at the end of her life, and she fears that maybe she won't get to die in the home that she knows and loves. She's in a foreign apartment, just sitting there waiting, as a lot of people are. But that's not the only experience we're having. On my way in, I was talking to my aunt. My uncle had gone to Nabatiyeh. He's a first responder, and at the top of your show, Amy, you were talking about the municipal building in Nabatiyeh, where my family is from, that was targeted by the Israeli military today. In that building, the mayor of Nabatiyeh was killed, as were numerous city officials, and my uncle was in that building. We couldn't get a hold of him for a little bit, and we were able to get a hold of him. Some of his friends died, were killed, and this isn't the first time he's had friends killed as a first responder. As a first responder, five of his colleagues recently, as they were trying to get humanitarian aid out to people, they were seeking shelter in a church in Deir Dreya in Lebanon, and the Israeli military bombed the church that had only first responders in there. You know, my family has very extensive experience, indeed expertise, at surviving Israeli military violence. You know, southern Lebanon was occupied from 1982 until 2000, and so I have family members who've endured the torture, the abuse, the targeting. What my family members are reporting now is a level of inhumanity, of violence, of belligerence that we haven't seen before. People are afraid to show up to the sites that have been destroyed, because what the Israeli military is doing now is they'll bomb whoever shows up to pull bodies out from under the rubble. And that's what my uncle is. He's a first responder whose job it is to show up and pull out the bodies from under the rubble. And now even people like him are being targeted, not once or twice, but systematically. And so I'm an American. I feel like I have a specific responsibility in the world since my country is the one that is sending the weapons that are being used systematically to harm and kill civilians. And the best that I'm being told my government can offer is this leaked letter that you just referenced, the Biden administration officials warning the Netanyahu government that if they keep blocking that humanitarian aid in 30 days, they'll strongly consider what happens with the weapons that we're sending. Our leverage over the Israeli government is not about humanitarian aid. Our leverage with the Israeli government is about the weapons. The more weapons we send them, the more babies they kill. That's just how it works. And so stop sending the weapons. The what the folks in that municipal building where my uncle was in Lebanon, what they were doing is they were having a meeting about two trucks of humanitarian aid that had just gotten to Nabatieh. And it was volunteers and first responders and city officials meeting, thinking together, how are they going to get this aid out? What happened? The people administering the aid were the ones targeted and harmed and killed and traumatized. And so our leverage with the Israeli government is not in how many humanitarian trucks get in. It's in how many 2,000-pound bombs we send them to obliterate entire societies. I think our government would do better at actually using the leverage that it has.
And Abbas, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the displacement, an estimated 1.2 million people just in a few weeks, where are these folks supposed to go as Israel continues to advance into Lebanon?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Juan. Virtually everyone I know in Lebanon has been displaced. Most of my family lives in South Lebanon or in the southern suburbs of Beirut or in Beirut, the city proper. It's a situation where in the immediate aftermath of the very intense escalation, we had family members, friends with literally nowhere to go, staying on whatever is available Beirut Beach, just staying there, waiting for the bombs to stop. People are in these really weird situations where they're trying to find somewhere else in Lebanon to go, and they're being asked for a month's rent, a year's rent in advance, if they're able, in order to be able to seek shelter. This is a country that, prior to this specific inhumane escalation by the Israeli military, was already in a state of economic freefall. Most of the people being harmed are people who either live in poverty or live with the complexities of human life. I have a cousin just a few days ago who showed up to my aunt's house after where he lives in central Beirut was bombed, and he showed up to my aunt's house covered in debris. With him, it was him and his wife and their two college-aged children. Both he and his wife are people who are blind. And so, think about the complexities of human life that we try to account for. I'm a Democrat, so we talk about, the care economy. We talk about wanting to support people as they age, wanting to support people in their disabilities. People in all of their complexities are living through the complexities of their everyday life, and simultaneously, the walls around them are caving in on them, are slamming down on their heads. What are we even talking about as Democrats if we speak so much to the value of human life, of the dignity of workers, when our party's official policy is to send more and more weapons to a fascist government that is on a killing spree, on a baby killing spree? And so it's the realities of being displaced. It's not just sort of I'll move from one apartment to another. It's everything around you, your entire existence is uprooted. It's a violent, violent reality.
So,
I wanted to ask you, what have you asked those, you and others in the uncommitted movement of the Harris campaign? What's been their response? And what do you say to people who say, well, let's get Harris elected into office because Trump is too dangerous and we'll work on shifting her position once she's in the White House?
My message to every Democratic voter who's voting for Harris, to every person who identifies as a progressive, to every person who believes in the sanctity of every child, the sacredness of every child, of every elder, of every worker, the time to say that you will hold Harris accountable is not after the election, it's now. If you intend on voting for Harris, you know, the great leader and Palestinian-American scholar Noor Arakat came out with a thread yesterday on Twitter where she's urging everyone who is voting for Harris, don't vote for Harris in private, state publicly that you are voting for Kamala Harris, and be specific about how you will be accountable to the people, the Palestinian-Americans who currently have family enduring a genocide. How will you be accountable to them? How are you insisting, even through your vote, that you will hold Democrats accountable to stop the weapons that are flowing to harm and kill civilians? So that's my message to every voter hearing this. If you're going to vote for Harris, I believe that we've got to block Donald Trump. If you believe that, then state that publicly and say, and once we block Donald Trump, here's how I will hold Harris accountable. That during her first 100 days, she must achieve a ceasefire. And the way to achieve a ceasefire is to stop sending the weapons. So we have to state that publicly, and we have been doing everything we can to offer Vice President Harris opportunity after opportunity to meet the community that is experiencing this immense level of pain where they are. It just so happens that Vice President Harris needs every vote she can get in a state like Michigan, and a lot of us in Michigan are currently in a state of mourning, of mourning. My friend's father, Hash Kamel Jawad, was someone who was, like the people today in Nabatiya, trying to get humanitarian aid to people, and was killed for doing so by an Israeli military airstrike. He's an American. This is a community in a state of grief. And so, as we have been urging the vice president's team, please, please meet with people who are directly impacted. Meet with Lebanese Americans and meet with Palestinian Americans who have had family killed over there by the bombs that the vice president's and the president's administration is sending. What we've been told repeatedly is, you know, the vice president is very busy. She's on the campaign trail. She can't really be taking meetings like that right now. And then the next day, we'll see the vice president has met. They put out a release saying she met with Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, but she only meets with people who have endorsed her campaign. That's an inappropriate posture to have at this moment. If you are going to Michigan and ask these people for their vote, you need to recognize that Arab American, Palestinian American communities right now are in a state of grieving, and you have an obligation, a responsibility to sit down and hear from them. We've heard over the past year repeated reports of the administration prioritizing meetings with the families of Israeli Americans who have family being held hostage in Gaza. It's important that the administration hear from those families. Why is it that the president, that the vice president have not taken the time to sit down with Palestinian American families who have family over there? I have asked this question repeatedly of the vice president's team. I was told that, you know, she's spoken to some families in the past. She's had sit downs in the past, but also I was told explicitly that she has not sat down with a single Palestinian American family who has a family killed in Gaza this year, in the year 2024. What are you waiting for? Vice President Harris. And you know, Amy, you had Dr. Sidwa here. Those doctors, those U.S. medical workers, they have been asking Vice President Harris to sit down with them. She won't do it. President Biden won't do it. And so, in my estimation, it feels like Vice President Harris is not doing what it takes to be both humane and compassionate and sensitive to the political realities in Michigan that are necessary to engage with in order to beat Donald Trump. And so, everybody who's going to try and beat Donald Trump, despite that, needs to make a public commitment now that they'll hold Vice President Harris accountable, especially during her first 100 days, to stop the weapons from flowing to Netanyahu's killing spree.
Abbas Alawi, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of the Uncommitted Movement. Next up, we look at the election. Harris and Trump ramping up efforts to appeal to the Latinx community. Why are some of them moving to the right? Stay with us.
Heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing, hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair. She broke your throne, she cut your hair, and from your lips she drew a hallelujah.
Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, performed by Rufus Wainwright. Both Wainwright and the Leonard Cohen estate have criticized Donald Trump for playing the song during his town hall, that unusual town hall in Pennsylvania, when the former president stopped taking questions and turned the event into a dance party of sorts, playing music for more than 30 minutes. Wainwright said, quote, witnessing Trump and his supporters commune with his music last night was the height of blasphemy. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. With just 19 days until the presidential election, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are ramping up efforts to appeal to a major voting bloc in battleground states, Latinx voters. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris appeared at a town hall with Latinx voters in Las Vegas, Nevada, hosted by Univision last week. She took a question from Yvette Castillo.
And I'm an American citizen, born to two Mexican parents. They were here before I was even born. They've worked their whole lives. But with the way immigration laws change over time, I was only able to help my dad get his legal status squared away, but not my mom's. My mom passed away just 6 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And she was never, ever able to get the type of care and service that she needed or deserved. Sorry.
Take your time.
So my question for you is, what are your plans, or do you have plans to support that subgroup of immigrants who have been here their whole lives, or most of them, and have to live and die in the shadows?
There are real people who are suffering because of an inability to put solutions in front of politics. I mean, an example of this on immigration policy is that as it relates to what we need to do to strengthen our border.
Meanwhile, Republican candidate Donald Trump will take the stage with Latinx voters tonight in Miami at a town hall also hosted by Univision. For more, we go to Austin, Texas. We're joined by Marissa Franco, director and co-founder of Mejente, a national organizing hub for Latinx and Chicanx communities. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We had you on at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, Marissa. I wanted to get first your response to Kamala Harris. What she responded to, this very emotional plea, was the support of the Biden administration for the bill that militarizes the border further. Your response to the Democratic and Republican approach to how to deal with the immigration crisis in this country.
Hey there, thanks for having me. That story is heartbreaking, and it's a story that many, many people experience in this country. We are now close to 40 years since the last legalization in this country. Vice President Harris's response is insufficient. The woman was not talking about the border. She was talking about the fact that her mother lived in this country, contributed to this country, and was part of her community, and was her mother, and could not get the care she needed and had no recourse. And all around, we've seen, like she mentioned, she was able to adjust the status for her father, but wasn't able for her mom. There has been, unfortunately, immigration reform in this country. It has been deportation first and building a huge infrastructure to survey, to identify and detain folks. And that includes at the border. What we're seeing at the border is horrible. The border bill was not going to be a solution, and it will not be a solution for Vice President Harris to mimic Donald Trump's policies on immigration. In fact, she has to contrast. I think Latinos, by and large, even when they say immigration or border security is an issue for them, it's a much more nuanced view. I think people want a fair shake, and they're seeing that. I think what's happening is that folks are generally, this is not just an issue in Latino community, but generally working class people are, the math isn't mathing. Whether it's their wages, whether it's their job conditions or the cost of living where, you know, just trying to make it, people are barely keeping their heads above water. And what Donald Trump has presented is who's at fault. And instead of it being the billionaire class, instead of it being corporations not paying their fair share, he's blaming the easiest people to blame, which has been done time immemorial in this country, which is blame immigrants, blame the other. Kamala Harris is not contrasting that sufficiently enough, and she didn't answer that woman's question. And I think the question remains, what will happen to folks who have been living, working, part of our community in this country, who have no real recourse to be able to adjust their status in this country?
And now I wanted to ask you, Marisa, what's your sense of the enthusiasm for voting? Clearly, in 2020, there was a huge surge of Latino voters in the last election. But there are key states. A lot of people focus on Arizona. But I also keep reminding people that there's a million Latinos who live in the state of Pennsylvania, perhaps the biggest yes. battleground state. What is your sense of the enthusiasm among Latinx voters on in terms of this election?
I think Harris-Walz will win the majority of Latino voters in this election. That, to me, is very clear. At the same time, it's never been Trump's goal to win the majority of Latino voters. He just has to win enough of a sliver of it. And I do think there are real cracks. And I don't know that the right question is, like, is Harris doing enough? Is the Harris campaign doing enough? I think this in many ways, that campaign's behind the eight ball in terms of what the Democratic Party has done over the last many, many years in terms of their posture, not just to Latinos, but to Black Americans, to working class people broadly in this country. I think the enthusiasm is, it's, you know, I think there was a surge after Biden stepped out and she came in. And I think it's leveled out. And I think it's the economy that's really, really hurting. And the fact that Biden is not popular and she's not contrasting herself enough. And so in those states where it's going to be very, very close, I am somewhat concerned that there's not going to be enough of a margin because I think that there's, you know, I think a lot of people don't know exactly what her plan is, or the plans that are being put out are not really capturing folks' imagination or interest. So I think it's going to be very close, and I don't know that there's huge enthusiasm, I would say, in the community right now.
And Marisa Franco, would you say that the corporate media is accurate in saying that there is a rightward shift within segments of the Latinx community? We have 30 seconds.
No, absolutely not. I think what Latinos are doing is declaring their political independence from partisan politics. I think the Latinos are looking to see who is going to deliver. I think even if Harris's message is resonating, even if they reject Trump's values and the way he acts, which many do, they fundamentally don't believe that the Democrats will deliver. And that is something that's at the doorstep of the Democratic Party and them deciding, are they truly the class of working people in this country, or are they the class of the sort of upper middle, like corporate sections, like liberal but still corporate. And I think that's what Latinos are questioning. I don't think that they're going to the right. They're looking to see who actually
Marisa
cares about
Franco,
them and is going to actually deliver.
I want to thank you for being with us ahead of Magente. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.